Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. So it's been a busy week at the Institute. We had a function last night and another one tonight. Tonight the topic is banking. So I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Joseph Healy was educated at the University of London. He's a career banker. He's also the author of a book, Corporate Finance, in 2003. His entire career has had a passionate interest in the role of banks and the economy. Currently, he's a group executive, business banking at the National Australia Bank. And in that position, he's responsible for all the banks dealing with all business. That is big business, small business and medium-sized business. So it's very appropriate tonight in the current economic developments worldwide that Mr. Healy's found time to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic Australian Banks, Sinners or Saints. We'll talk for about half an hour, a bit shorter than that, and we'll take questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. Mr. Healy, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard. And let me extend a very warm welcome to all of you here this evening. Thank you, and welcome to the National Australia Bank. Looking around the room, it's fantastic to see such an audience interested in banking. When I started off in banking some 26 years ago, it was always an industry that was associated with being boring. But I think that's certainly not been true of the industry over the last decade or so, and it's a good time in the midst of this global financial crisis just to kind of reflect back on the role that the banks play in the economy. So good evening, everyone. I'd like to thank the Sydney Institute and to Gerard Henderson in particular for the opportunity to talk to you this evening. The Institute has a unique and valuable contribution to Australian intellectual life. I trust and I hope that's going to be the case going out into the future. So thank you, Gerard, and also a welcome to Nick Johnson, the Chairman of the Institute. And thank you also to everyone in the room for being here tonight and giving me an opportunity to take up some of your time to give you some of my views on thoughts and musings on a topic of that's very near and dear to my heart, and that is the role of the banks, and particularly the Australian banks within the community. Hardly a week has gone by in recent months where the actions or the inactions of an Australian bank has not been a hot topic of media, community and political discourse. Interest rates, lending practices, executive remuneration, jobs, in fact even the proposed arrangements for a bank's social function has been discussed, dissected and in most cases condemned. I think it's pretty fair to say that the apparent disconnect between the Australian banks and the expectations of many in politics, in the media and most importantly broadly across the community is as wide as it has ever been. This disconnect, of course, is not a new phenomenon. Sadly, it's been with us for decades, and it's also not just a phenomenon true of the banks. I think there are a number of industries and big businesses, I can think of the oil sector as one example, and there are many others, that suffer from occasionally the same kind of disconnect. But as our CEO, Cameron Klein, said in a recent speech, the banks must share some of the blame for this disconnect. And we all know the reasons for it. At NAB, we're acutely aware that the actions such as branch closures and the level of fees that are seen by many as undermining customer and societal trust. We also know that decisions on mortgage and small business interest rates attract a lot of media and political interest, leaving customers with the impression sometimes that the banks are making these decisions with no regard for their interests. When set against profits that are measured in the billions, one can understand why bank bashing has almost become a national pastime. As an industry, I believe we have to acknowledge that some of this criticism is justified. Have we engaged sufficiently with our customers and the broader community on these issues? I think the honest answer is not enough. For too long, banks have hidden behind the excuse that bank bashing is largely ill-informed comment, and sometimes it is. But sometimes the criticism is valid, and we need to be part of the debate. And that's not easy. The sceptical Scott in me says that it's much easier for a politician or a talkback radio host to criticise banks rather than to acknowledge that the Australian banks are proven to be remarkably resilient, especially in the face of the global financial crisis, and particularly when you contrast our banks to the banks in many markets around the world. But this scepticism is misplaced. The sad reality is that despite the fact that banks are an integral part of our economy, and almost every Australian has a relationship with a bank, either as a customer, as an employee, or as a shareholder, that most people still don't fully understand the fundamental role that banks play in our economy and in our society. Banks simply need to do a much better job in engaging in this debate. We must be on the front foot. Listen and seek to understand the criticism, present the facts, and be engaged in the debate, so that hopefully we better inform society on the fundamental roles that banks play. Closer to home, at NAB, we owe it to the 40,000 hardworking employees that we are actively involved in this debate, because they are obviously always conscious of the angst that they hear about, the community angst on the role of the banks, and our employees are a critical part of the business and community fabric of this country, and they're entitled to feel as proud of the role that their bank plays and the banking industry plays generally in the success and well-being of our country. So better articulating that role is a challenge for every leader in our industry. So what is the role of banking? Well, banking can be credited with the miracle of liquidity creation, Banks lend and acquire assets that are basically illiquid, 3-5 year loans, that are basically illiquid, and even at the best, in the best of conditions, trying to convert those loans and other assets into cash can be a very timely and expensive exercise if it can indeed be done. Yet depositors in banks, whose money largely funds those illiquid assets, have an expectation that those deposits can be converted into cash almost instantly at a very little cost and on demand. So this core skill of a good bank is to take those deposits and invest those deposits in the in productive capacity in the economy, be those deposits from deposit holders or monies borrowed from other institutions who lend to banks, or shareholders' money, to take those monies and invest them by lending money to other businesses and to households who need access to capital, and to do so in a way that when those monies are called back or acquired back, that they can indeed be returned. So the core skill of a good banker fulfilling this fundamental role is that of risk management, making sure that the risks that the bank take are as such that the monies can indeed be repaid. So at this most basic level, banks help businesses and people, governments and communities, to function by providing finance. Banks also provide the mechanism for funds to be transmitted domestically and internationally. And through ATMs and electronic banking, banks provide customers with 24-hour access to their money. About 75% of the loans to help Australians acquire their quarter-acre dream are provided by banks. And so to my mind, the economics of banking has three core characteristics. First, to have the confidence of trust and trust of our customers and the communities. Second, the ability to fund the business of banking at a rate lower than the margin earned from lending out funds. And third, the ability to manage the risk of lending and other bank activities. Today, the environment that we see today highlights how these three core functions are intrinsically linked. Bank funding costs have been rising over the past year because Australia as a nation relies heavily on the international capital markets to fund our demand for domestic credit. We don't have sufficient savings in the economy to meet the funding debt requirement needs of our society. And the cost of international funding has gone up significantly over the last year. Interest rates set by the Reserve Bank aren't the only factor in determining the price of credit to our customers. And this is a message that banks have got to do a better job at explaining, because so many in our society look at the Reserve Bank cash rate and think that equals the cost of banks funding their businesses. Indeed, it does not. And in the last year, that gap between the real cost and the cash Reserve Bank cash rate has widened by quite some margin. We're also seeing an increase in risk as consumers and businesses adjust to a slowing economy. And if forecasts of slower activity in the economy and higher employment hold true, then we can expect to see the level of bad debts to rise. And indeed, we are forecasting that that will be the case through 2010. So in these tough times, bankers are reminded of the importance of the need to manage risk and how integral a well-managed banking system is to businesses and to the health of our economy. Again, we only have to contrast and look at the situation overseas to see the impact, both in an economic sense and a society sense, of a weak banking system. Now, if banks are to maintain a strong capital levels heading into a slowdown, they will only remain strong if they're delivering profits. And in order to remain strong and play that role, strong role in the economy, they must maintain a strong capital position. This is often missed in the current discussion around the role of bank profitability. And certainly, the best way to think about the strength of a bank is through the level of profitability that the banks are able to generate, the level of profits the banks are able to generate. This is, as I say, is not a prism that is often viewed, but in fact, it's a more insightful way to think of a bank rather than the often hyped headline profit figures. So while banks, for example, can announce a profit of $4 billion, which is a huge number, $4 billion, what is often lost in the analysis that banks can have assets or risk assets in the order of $400 billion generating that $4 billion. So the return on risk or the return on assets can be no greater than 1%, around about 1%, which is hardly a high level of profitability. And let me explain, illustrate why profits are so easily misconstrued and sometimes with disastrous results. But back in the early 90s, there was a British bank called National Westminster. And I remember it announced half-year profits of £1.3 billion, which was an 82% increase on the previous half. And that was largely because bad debts had come down. But the tabloid media, on hearing the £1.3 billion half-year results, had sensational headlines calling banks piggy banks and excessive profits and daylight robbery. Whereas if you turn to the more serious financial press, they were saying that the bank was in deep trouble, that the performance was way below market expectations, and there was serious confidence, a crisis of confidence in the quality of management and the viability of the bank's future. The bank's customers and employees in the main were influenced by the tabloid media. Times haven't changed. While management, of course, spent a lot of time focusing on the more serious financial media. The political reaction reflected the popular sentiment, whilst at the same time morale within the bank collapsed. And within months of that half-year result announcement, National Westminster Bank was acquired by another British bank. Hundreds of bank branches were closed, and thousands of staff lost their job. And today we're seeing a rerun of that history when we look at the events in the banking industry in the United Kingdom and the United States, and indeed in other parts of Europe. So we're well versed at counting bank profits, but far less knowledgeable at understanding the real cost to employees and society of a poorly run bank. All four of Australia's AA-rated major banks currently carry Tier 1 capital of approximately 8%. So on a $400 billion asset balance sheet, that equates to about $32 billion of Tier 1 capital. Now, compared to any other business, that level of debt to equity is a very high level and one that has to be very carefully and prudently managed. When I talk about equity in a bank's capital structure, I like to compare it to an airbag in a car. Rarely used in the hands of a safe driver. In fact, in the hands of a safe driver, it should never be used. But if there's a crash, the bigger the airbag, the better. And the bigger the car and the faster the car has been driven, then the bigger that airbag is needed to survive. Recent events have shown that many banks overseas have been driving fast cars with very little in the way of airbags. And those banks are either out of business or surviving on the good support of their governments today. So not surprisingly, there's been much criticism of the management of banks in Europe and the United States. And given the terrible economic and social consequences of the financial crisis in those regions, it's fair to say that much of that criticism is warranted. And inevitably, there's going to be a lot tougher regulatory governance around the banking industry. I think that's a reality that the banking industry internationally will face into. But what's the situation in Australia? What about the Australian banks? Well, our banks today are four of only eight AA-rated banks in the world, a very select company. I believe that even the critics of the Australian banks would agree that one of the key reasons why our economy has managed so well in this global turbulence is that a strong banking industry has helped mitigate some of the consequences of a slower economic downturn. And particularly when you compare that to the situation in other markets around the world, where weak banking systems have been associated with very weak economies. In the UK, as an example, announced yesterday that its GDP had shrunk by 2.5%, the lowest decline in economic growth in about 50 years, I think. And the fact that its banking system is largely on its knees, not all the banks, but some of the main banks, is no coincidence there. Whereas here, our banking system is strong, and our economy, touch wood, is managing well through this global turbulence. And credit's available. Sure, credit conditions have tightened, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment or two. But credit is very much available, not so the case in other parts of the world. Now, I'm not claiming for one second that NAB saw the global financial crisis coming. We don't boast a Nostradamus on our staff. That said, I can say in the business bank, we've been thinking about the prospect of a deteriorating economic environment for quite some time. And there were three things that really got us thinking about the prospect of a slower, and in fact, a significantly slower economic environment. The first was the publication of a book called The Black Swan, which some of you may have heard of. The book was published or written by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and it describes a black swan event. Now, for those who may be puzzled by the use of the term black swan is very much a Northern Hemisphere mystery. In other words, very rare do you see black swans in the Northern Hemisphere, but of course they're quite common here. But US authors tend to view the world very much through a US lens, and so the use of the black swan. But the principle of the concept is a powerful one, and it has three traits. The first trait is that it's an unusual occurrence. It's a real outlier event, not something that happens routinely. The second trait is that when it does happen, the consequences can be huge. The impact can be significant. And thirdly, it's after the event that people rationalise what happened. Rationalise it in a way that sounds as if it could have been predicted. So for example, the US subprime crisis is a classic black swan event. 4 or 5 years ago, no one would have seen that risk. But sitting here today, we all say, what on earth were banks lending to people who couldn't afford to pay back the loans? Classic black swan event. The book is an excellent book, and it got me thinking about what could happen in our economy that might not be predicted through our traditional models or our traditional risk management tools. The second thing that got me thinking about the risk in our economy was a piece of research published by one of the leading consulting firms. That research showed that the growth in the global financial system relative to the global GDP had gone from about 106% of global GDP in 1996 to over 600% in 2006. Now, by any yardstick, that is a phenomenal growth in the financial system. And it greatly concerned me. Because what it was suggesting was a disconnect, a serious disconnect, from the level of activity in the financial markets and the level of activity in the so-called real economy, the level of economic activity. And history also tells us when we start seeing that kind of disconnect, it's often symptomatic of bubbles. So it was pause for reflection. I remember the day when I read that article. It was the Financial Times. I was sitting here in Sydney, and I thought, boy, this is a serious piece of information that we've got to start thinking about. The third reason or a factor that got me thinking about a changing environment was the high prices that businesses were being bought for, mainly by the private equity community, but not only by the private equity community. Prices in terms of multiples of earnings, which historically businesses were being bought for, say, 4 or 5 times their earnings before depreciation and tax. And that had moved to 7, 8, and sometimes 10 times earnings. Now, the reason why I was concerned about that is that a lot of these acquisitions were financed by debt. And the concern was, how would these businesses manage if and when the economy slowed? When people make acquisitions, they never ever factor in slowdowns. Because it's often emotional. People tend to project a never-ending trajectory of growth. I remember one of the lessons, early lessons that I learned as a banker that I'll never forget, and that is that if you overpay, you overfinance. And in the event of a crash, there's no airbag. And so that got me worried about what was happening in our economy. Our response to these changes was to start thinking about risk management, as all good bankers should do, and all good business people should do. We started hiring a lot of senior experienced bankers, grey-haired bankers. We moved a lot of our risk people into frontline roles because we were conscious that over the last 16 or 17 years, we had enjoyed a somewhat benign economic environment, and a lot of bankers didn't have the experience of dealing with distressed customers and dealing with an economic environment that was hostile. So we started investing and changing the configuration of our resources, recognizing that not since the early 90s were we going to look into an environment that was very different. But more important than that, I think, we started working with our customers. We began a campaign of educating our customers about the need to give greater consideration to the risks they were facing. And again, entrepreneurs and a lot of boards, although they think for a second about risks, the dominant paradigm is about growth and how can we continue to grow our business. And it was very important that we started getting people thinking about an environment that could be very hostile to them. And again, recognizing that just as with some of our bankers who hadn't seen a recession, there are many businesses that weren't around in the early 1990s, and so there were many business operators and many executives in senior positions of businesses that had no experience of managing in a more hostile economic environment. We talked a lot about the tale of the frog in the boiling water, that well-known metaphor that is told to explain how people fail to react to important changes that occur gradually, and sometimes it's only when the temperature is very hot and conditions are boiling that they wake up to that reality. But of course, it can often be too late. And so that was a big focus for us. So being on the front foot and helping our customers think about the adjustments they needed to make was an important part of our risk management and a very important part of their risk management. And what was the end result of that strategy? Bankers and accountants and other people tend to like to measure these things as proof of their success. Well, the reality is it's very difficult to measure how successful these initiatives actually are because you're avoiding problems that occur. But we are confident that had we not been more proactive in working with our customers and more proactive in investing in the skills of our bankers and bringing more experience into the bank, But the bad and doubtful debt position and problems that we are facing today would have been significantly greater had we not taken those steps. Now, I'd like to just talk a little bit about our customers and start by talking about our SME customers. It's no secret, because there's a few people in this room who I know quite well, and it'll be no secret to them just how passionate I am about business banking, and especially small to medium-sized businesses, what we call SME businesses. In SME banking, relationship banking is critical to the success of our customer and to the success of our bank. In other words, really understanding over a long period of time the aspirations and the needs of SME customers. This involves having bankers and having a business that's willing to commit bankers to staying in the same job, in the same communities over a long period of time. Now, I emphasize that because I remember when I started out in banking, I was working for a US bank, and the CEO of that US bank said to me at the time, "Joe," Americans always abbreviate your name, "Joe, we're not a major player in mid-market banking," mid-market being SME banking in the US, "either in the US or overseas, because success in that business requires long-term continuity of people who are part of the local community. We don't attract people who want to go to live in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and stay there for 25 years. And so it's not a business that we are interested in." His statement, of course, is one that stayed with me almost 25 years. In fact, it is about 25 years. But it reminds me of a critical success in the business of banking SME customers, and that is the commitment to long-term relationships and the commitment to local communities. In the National Australia Bank, we have a business model called Integrated Financial Services, or IFS, which has this very idea at its heart. Now, as the biggest bank in Australia to the SME sector, NAB understands how important this is. And in my opinion, it's a good illustration of the church spire principle of banking, which was recently mentioned in an article on banking in The Economist magazine. The principle says that only lend to those businesses and those customers within sight of the church spire. In other words, businesses and people that you know well. Unlike Australian banks, this principle has been lost on many banks in the UK and the United States in the heady days leading up to the subprime crisis. But I believe it helps explain why our banks and our banking system is proving much more resilient in the global financial crisis. We did not stray too far away from the church tower spiral. So, for me, relationship banking is a large part of the reason why I enjoy my job so much, because I hear wonderful stories of businesses that came to the bank, often with nothing but a dream, and in the case of so many migrants that came to this country with nothing more than an empty suitcase, and received the financial support for the bank, backing their ideas. And that support has transformed their lives and has created employment opportunities for many, many, many Australians. The willingness of the bank to support entrepreneurs, including thousands of migrants, is an enormous source of professional pride, as is the fact that the bank stands behind many customers who are facing financial difficulty. And since the onset of the credit crunch, a lot has been said about banks not lending to SMEs, and we've certainly seen some withdrawal from the foreign banks, from the non-bank financial institutions, and from some of the regional banks. However, I'm pleased to say that we have continued to be open for business, and in the last 12 months, we've loaned in excess of $20 billion to SMEs here in Australia. $20 billion. Now, this capital, and this excludes the lending that we've provided to large institutional customers, and I'll talk about those in a moment, this capital largely goes in to help finance the economic activity that we see all around us, that ensures that the wheels of this economy continue to turn. And we're very proud of that level of commitment. I think, by some margin, it would be the biggest level of commitment of any bank in Australia. We also continue to work on programs that go to the very heart of lending to small businesses. And we have a not-for-profit program called NAB's Micro Enterprise Loan. This program looks at providing business finance to those people who have a very good business idea and a well-thought-through business plan and a passion and work ethic to translate that into success, but who are not able to access traditional forms of finance. This is something that we've been working on since 2007, and I'm delighted by the fact that we have been able to establish over 200 micro-businesses since 2007, and that's something that we're enormously proud of, but not something that we talk too much about. It's a source of enormous pride. For these reasons, I personally am reassured that in our quiet contribution to the success of this country is something that makes my chosen vocation one of great personal satisfaction. Now, I mentioned institutional bank customers. I'd like to just talk for a moment on institutional customers. By institutional customers, I mean large corporates rather than small businesses. And let me start by saying that institutional customers equally value the relationship they have with the bank, although the nature of that commitment to that relationship tends to change over time and largely depending on the state of the economic environment. When there is much liquidity in the system and new entrants in the market, institutional clients in the main, this is not true of all, but in the main, tend to select service and products based on price. The mantra here is shareholder value, and so the best price gets the deal, regardless necessarily of previous relationship commitments. Now, whilst institutional clients value relationships, sometimes banks feel that relationship is more akin to a call option, that we will call on it when we need it rather than invest in it over time. Now, I'm making a general statement here. But to me, this is very much the paradox of relationship banking in the institutional market. In challenging times, relationships are very important. In less challenging times, the focus tends to be on other criteria. I think what the recent global financial crisis has highlighted, however, is a fallacy that had gained much currency over the last decade, and that is that the capital markets and the banks are perfect substitutes. In other words, I can borrow from the capital markets or I can borrow from the banks. The way that the capital markets have abruptly closed down for many companies reminds all companies, in my view, and particularly executives and boards of directors, of the importance of strong banking relationships. So for me, hopefully one of the positives that we will see out of the global financial crisis is going back to a time when businesses of all sizes value the importance of relationships and invested in those relationships. And equally, in the case of institutional businesses, that sensible pricing for risk is a feature of those relationships going forward. So ladies and gentlemen, these are some of the concrete benefits that banks bring to Australia. Whether it be businesses, individuals or investors, what has underpinned the banking system in achieving these goals has been a strong regulatory system, which is particularly important when you bear in mind the important role that banks play in the payment system in our economy. But let me conclude by saying that I have no doubt Australian banks can and must lift their game at better engaging with their customers and the broader community. We do need to be more transparent, whether it's be it fees, interest rates, profitability, or services. And this is a commitment that National Australia Bank CEO Cameron Klein has publicly made, that we as a bank are committed to greater transparency because we believe that it will lead to higher levels of trust and strengthening our relationships with our customers and the broader community. We have nothing to fear in making this commitment towards greater transparency, because at NAB, I believe, on balance, we have a very good story to tell. Our customers and depositors get stability, they get security, and they get access to credit, which, as I mentioned several times, is the lifeblood of any economy. We also employ tens of thousands of Australians, and our investors receive a dividend, which many of whom rely on that dividend to finance lifestyle and retirement. We're very conscious of that. So make no mistake, we and the industry we work in and represent do need to do better, but the Australian banking system, working in cooperation with government and with the Reserve Bank, deserves credit for the way that it's handled the global financial crisis and how it is now positioned to help play a crucial role in helping our economy work through the challenges and the stresses that we see in front of us. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks. So we come to questions and discussion. I should firstly thank the NAB for the use of this fund facility this evening. It's the first time we've been here, so thanks for that. So we've finished no later than 7 o'clock. Going back to your concept of the church tower and all that, it has been suggested that one of the reasons why the Australian banking system has done better than comparable banks in Western Europe or North America, well, in the United States, and the Canadians have done pretty well too, is that this stability has something to do with the existence of the four pillars policy, which I think the Keating government commenced and the Peter Costello as treasurer continued. I don't know where the National stands on that, but how do you attribute the fact that we've got four banks and we can't have three or two as adding the stability, or do you think that's of no particular relevance to what's been a reasonably impressive performance?
Well, it's a very topical question. I believe that the strength of the banking system in Australia is down to a number of factors, not down to any single factor. It's down to a strong economic environment. It's down to a good regulatory system. It's down to a very constructive role that the Reserve Bank has played in the economy. And it's down to good management in the banks. Now, you mentioned the church and spiral. And it's an important point, because when you look at the problems that other banks have faced overseas, it's largely because they've overextended themselves outside their domestic market. They've chased growth in the United States, or they've chased growth in Eastern Europe, in the case of some European banks. But the United States in particular has been seen as the holy grail for growing bank profitability. Now, the Australian banks are and have been in the United States, but the relative size of our activities in the United States are very small. Whereas if you look at some of the UK banks, for example, they were heavily exposed to offshore markets in the United States in particular. I believe that the large focus on our domestic market, on our church town spiral, has been one of the major factors for the relatively strong position that the banks find themselves in. But there are other factors. The four pillar policy may or may not be a factor. I certainly don't subscribe to that as a reason why the banking system is so strong. I put it down to a number of factors, as I mentioned.
Question, John. John McKinney. Joseph, the theme of your talk tonight is putting banks safe. So I just want to concentrate on sitting side. You've been on the safety side most of the time. One of the great things in the last 20 years is the development of competition in your sector.
Yeah.
One of the things with global economic crisis is this has dropped considerably over the last 2 years. Competitors of the four pillars have dropped market share from 42% to 25%. Mm-hmm. So competition is reducing. Now, how can we guarantee that we won't be going back to the bad old days, less competition, but greater bank margins, and therefore things being more difficult for business and home buyers in a less competitive market?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, an excellent question, a very topical question. I would challenge the view that there's less competition in the market simply because there are fewer players in the market. I think having a market, and being conscious of the fact that this is a relatively small economy, 22 million people, having four very, very strong banks is more conducive to competition than having eight, you know, weak banks. And you only have to look, for example, in any newspaper at the rates, and let's take deposits as an example, at the rates that banks are willing to pay for deposits, a strong evidence of very healthy competition. So I believe that, I don't think it's a question of size, I think it's a question of banks looking to grow their businesses, because businesses do seek to grow in a sustainable way. And being strong enhances your ability to compete. At the same time, of course, there's huge amount of oversight. The media plays a significant role in this regard, as do the politicians, as indeed do the regulators. So I think the kind of environment that people sense may have existed a number of years ago is not the environment that we're in today. And whilst there has been a retreat of some capacity, that capacity can come back into the market at any time. I mean, we've seen a few banks leave the market. We have seen banks reduce their activity in the market. And I think back to a key theme of my speech, is that banks, and certainly in the case of the National Australia Bank, are very, very conscious of reputation and of the need to build trust in the communities that we operate in. And if there was any sense of behaviour in the industry that undermined that trust, it would just set the whole agenda and undermine the credibility of those who've made commitments back. So I believe competition is healthy in the marketplace. I see it all the time. And there's significant oversight to ensure that that competition remains that way.
So we've got plenty of questions. We go here and there and there. Yeah. Hi, Mum. I'm a small businessman. When small business people get together in the last year or so, the easy topic of small talk has shifted from the footy and the weather to people's difficulties in getting bank finance. People, small business people, and indeed their advisors, accountants and the like, regularly swap stories of banks cutting back funding lines, banks being not just interest rates going up and margins going up, as you quite rightly pointed out, but simply the supply of credit, even to existing borrowers with projects half completed, being very substantially cut back, and in some cases long-standing clients of banks being forced to fire sale their assets on terms that can sometimes destroy businesses. What's your response to that common talk among business people?
Well, I hear those comments as well, and we've been in active discussion with government, because government, particularly through Minister Emerson, has been a leader in representing small businesses and dealing with this perception. I think that there's a number of things that have happened in our system over the last 12 months, and let me give you some context. As of 12 months ago, the big four banks constituted about two-thirds of the total lending into the domestic business market. And about one-third was made up of foreign banks were about 15%, regional banks were at around about 7%, and 5%, and then the non-bank financial institutions, the G Capitals and of that, people of that ilk, represented the 7%. What we've seen is a pullback in that capacity from that broad one-third segment, largely because funding has become very challenging for them, and also because some institutions have got problems in their own backyards, and some institutions have just had other problems domestically to deal with. So we have seen about that one-third, which has grown quite aggressively over the preceding decade, suddenly start to shrink, and you'll see that banks, the major banks, have started to grow their share. Some people put that down to less competition in the case of the National Australia Bank, I see it as us stepping in and helping finance business that is not able to find finance from sources that it had traditionally found it from. So I think there is a reduction in overall market capacity. And some banks, also including the National Australia Banks, in certain sectors of the economy where risks have gone up, are obligated to act prudently in making sure that any lending that is provided is done in a way that does not expose the business to an unacceptable level of risk, because it's in no one's interest for that to happen. So there have been adjustments made, but I would hate to think that any of your remarks would be true of a customer of the National Australia Bank, because as I mentioned in my speech, that we have loaned in excess of $20 billion over the last 12 months. We've grown our market share in SME banking to close to 30%. Our focus has been very much in the market to support customers and help businesses, but we are conscious that in other parts of the economy, other lenders, particularly the three categories that I mentioned, have been pulling back. I think there's a need to ensure that there's a proper debate ongoing here. Sometimes businesses believe that banks are acting too hastily in reducing lending or increasing margins. But the other side of the coin is that banks are seeing a significant risk emerging in certain sectors. And rather than waiting for that risk to crystallize, it's in everybody's interest that we take steps early to avoid the kind of consequences that can flow when businesses get into difficulty.
Now, we've got to be quick for that question. We've got a question there, and then we'll go here, and then we'll go to the
Peter Gibson. I guess over the last 6 months or so, Australian corporates have raised about $60 to $70 billion in the capital markets in Australia. Most of the raisings have been led by the Australian arms of foreign banks, earning, I think, about 1.5. Tell me why Australian banks are not interested in this particular major centre of
Yes, that's a very good question, thank you. Now, the capital raising is mainly equity, that's $60 billion of equity, and I think what you find is that the Australian banks, which are largely commercial banks, focus mainly on debt, and are not. Some have equity practices, but are not strong in equity capital raising, whereas some of the foreign banks, well, the UBSs and the Deutsche Banks and the Goldmans, are well established in the equity capital markets, and they have been a natural port of call for companies looking to raise equity. Equity capital raising has not been historically a strength of the major Australian banks, and that's the reason. Should these major Australian banks look to get into the equity capital markets and help meet that need down the future? That's a question that's looked at almost on an annual basis, and some banks have done it and failed because sometimes the culture associated with running an equity business is a very different kind of culture from running a commercial banking business. And it's not to say that they can't work, and there are great examples, and Barclays being a good example of a bank internationally that does this very well, but it's not been something the Australian banks have done well. But it's a question that remains on the table. And when you start talking about, if our customers are looking for equity capital, when you start talking about the $1.5 billion of fees, it certainly concentrates the mind as to whether it's a business we should be in. But my own perspective is it's only a business that we should be in if it's a business we can do well, and that we can provide our customers with a first-class service in terms of execution. And until you can do that, you're not serving your customers well.
Several of the chief executives of banks in the UK and the US have all bailed out and justified their position by saying, well, this is all very regrettable, but how could we ever have predicted this unprecedented financial crisis and the contraction of liquidity? And to what extent would you share that view, that it was said it really was a black swan and really couldn't have been predicted by?
Well, business management is responsible for the strategy, the strategic choices that the business makes. And if a business decides to put a significant part of its balance sheet in markets that are far away from the church spiral, sometimes in activities where they have no natural competitive advantage in, then they are taking conscious decisions to take risks. Now, they'll answer that by saying there's a lot of pressure to grow profits and that margins have been squeezed heavily domestically, so let's start going overseas. I think that the biggest risk that any business takes centres on the strategic choices that it makes, and those are decisions that management takes. And you know, I hear the defence, but people are well paid to make the right kind of decisions and manage risk. And frankly, I think it's one thing going and losing billions of dollars in a foreign market, and that happens in lots of businesses. But losing sufficient amounts of money that cripple the whole bank, I think that requires quite a bit of explanation.
Buyer imagery is curious, and it reminded me that some banks are reaching out to Muslim men because they are interested in doing business with interest. I wondered whether the NAB is some interest area of non-Christian
Well, your question is, of course, is timely, because I think there's an article in one of today's newspapers that talked about
Financial Review.
Was it the Financial Review?
Yeah.
Well, and I have to say that that article was not an article that the NAB put out there or sponsored. It was an interpretation that a couple of commentators placed on a business that we developed, which was largely targeted at the segment of the economy that struggles with in getting access to finances. So it was a zero interest facility, which of course is very akin to some of the Islamic financing. And so people extrapolated our intent to help segments of the economy that were struggling to get access to capital, and said, well, that looks like Islamic finance, and NAB's in the Islamic finance business. Well, we have not said that. Now, having said all of that, we continue always to look at how we can help better serve communities, but we're not making any statement about identifying any particular sector of the community in terms of their faith as a focus right now. It's been a story that's kind of got with it, and we're not quite sure where from.
Okay, so we're running to the end. I think we'll take the question here. We'll make that the last year. We've got to be quick. Yep. Yes.
Interest rates. For small and medium-sized businesses, what do you feel is the outlook for the next 12 months and for the next 5 years, both nationally and internationally?
I think we got... Government and Treasury got a very similar question, and I think it might have been the same source and didn't answer it, I think, this bit.
Yeah.
Correctly so.
Well, it's very hard to forecast what interest rates are going to do. We do know that there's going to be a huge demand from governments and others to borrow from the international markets. That, in theory, should put pressure on interest rates. But I wouldn't want to make any forecasts on interest rates. I think we're enjoying interest rates today that are close to all-time lows. But all the trends around the world are suggesting that longer-term interest rates are likely to rise. But the one thing that the current economic environment of the last 12 months has told us all is just the difficulty in forecasting.
Just a final question. You're primarily responsible for business at the NAB. So how are you reading the economy due to your interactions with big business, medium-sized and small business?
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense of it all?
I think people are very cautious about the economy. I think people, in some sectors, there's been some optimism over the last month or so. But when you have serious discussions with people who are thinking carefully about the economy, there's still a sense that there's a lot of risk out there, and sometimes, you know, you can look at an economic report and feel that we're skating on solid ice, and then look at another report and think we're skating on thin ice. My own view is that it's a time for caution, and there's a lot still to be played out in the global economy. the success of the Australian economy is going to depend a lot on what happens internationally, and particularly in the US and China. So I think when you look at what's happened elsewhere around the world, particularly in the major economies around the world, there's no place else on earth that you would sooner be than here in Australia. We've seen some reduction in economic activity, but it's nothing relative to what we've seen around the world. But I just think we need to be vigilant and just see how the next 18 months, frankly, plays out, because I think it's only after we get through the second part of 2010 that we'll get some clear sense of how quickly we might see a recovery. So caution is the byword. And it's not because I'm a Scottish banker, it's just...
Many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you.
So, as usual, I'll be very brief. Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to our speaker. It's good to see a senior banker in Australia come along and from one of our big four and talk about such an important issue of the bank's role in the economy and Australian society, and take questions from the floor, some of whom were pushing the sinner's line and some the saint's line, but both aspects were covered. And it'll be great to run your paper in the Sydney papers. We'll put it up on our podcast tomorrow or the next day. And it continues the series we've been having through the year among the rest of our program, just looking at the global financial crisis and its impact on Australia. And that was an important continuation of that conversation, to use the current cliche, or discussion we've been having all year. So, Joseph Healy, many thanks for tonight, and no doubt we'll have you back in the future sometime. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.